Amen. Thanks, Krista. That's Krista. She's one of our elders. And I'm Andy. I'm one of the pastors. So it's nice to see you. Welcome, everybody. It's good to be together. Everyone found a seat for the most part. That's good. Nobody takes the front seats except a few brave souls. That's awesome. But I've got a good spit zone here, so that's good. No one's there. Just kidding. I don't spit, actually, at all. Well, we are in, like Krista mentioned, we're doing a course called Emotionally Healthy Spirituality, and we're also kind of echoing the themes of that course on Sunday mornings. And so we began two Sundays ago looking at the problem of emotionally unhealthy spirituality. That's what it is. I always get that all mixed up. Emotionally unhealthy spirituality, and why is that a problem? Like, what's the big deal? And last week, Rick Hill talked about knowing yourself that you may know God. And this morning, we're going to be talking about going back in order to go forward. It's all based on a little book by the same title of the Emotionally Healthy Spirituality. And the subtitle is, which is really the main guts, if you want to know what we're looking at in like a little pithy sentence, it's impossible to be spiritually mature while remaining emotionally immature. It's impossible to be spiritually mature and be emotionally immature at the same time. It doesn't work. And so that's really what we're looking at this whole fall season, and pursuing some health that way. So we're gonna jump in this morning. Soren Kierkegaard said, "Life is lived forward, but only understood backwards." I was having my morning tea this morning. We just moved houses. We have a house on the Red River now. And so, which is lovely, and I can sit in our living room and look out at the river, and I saw a lone rower rowing, you know, upstream, actually, and the river is really high, and it's flowing pretty fast, and so this rower was really, did you see it? You guys weren't there at the same time? It was you! Paul was rowing on the river this morning! And, but it's so neat how they kind of look backwards, but go forwards, though, hey? And that's really part of what we're going to be doing this morning, is going back in order to go forward. And one of the main kind of things of this morning is that we all have emotional baggage. Maybe not our baggage isn't emotional, like these are kind of emotional baggages, but we all carry emotional baggage in one way, shape, or another. Some of us have a small load because of where we've come from, you know, like healthy family environments. Some of us carry bigger loads. But we all have a load. We all have a load that we carry. Some of us have been so accustomed to carrying these loads that it just kind of seems normal. We don't even know that there's actually all this stuff on our backs that we're carrying with us in our current life. And it might be stuff that happened way long time ago, but it still is with us and it affects us currently. But there's freedom from that kind of stuff. And true spirituality frees us to live joyfully in the present. True spirituality frees us to live joyfully in the present. But this requires that we need to go back in order to go forward. We need to go back in order to go forward. These days, my family visits, I don't know about you, when you go and visit your family or when you are the family and people come to visit you. These days, my family visits are a little different because my mom is quite sick. She has ALS and she's barely can move her one right arm anymore. That's about all she can do. And her voice is kind of going, and so it's pretty bad. But a number of years ago, when I went home to visit my folks, I always, and if it was like a day, beyond a day, about a day was about the right amount of time, but anything beyond, I started acting like I was 15 again. Do you relate to that? Like, is that kind of how it is when you hang out with your folks? It's like, oh man, like, what is going on here? I'm like kind of reverting back to when I lived there and when, you know, and it was like an emotionally immature kind of time of my life. And and trying to be the tragic hero figure who was always in search of adventure, running from anything that had a hint of pain, and trying desperately to be interesting. That's me, okay? That was me when I was 15. And parts of it kind of live on as well. But that's kind of how it works, is that we have this stuff that we've grown up with that carries forward with us. And the kind of family, whatever your family of origin is, and I know there's lots of complex scenarios here, but whatever that family of origin is, there's baggage that you carry with you now. Okay, I want you to do, we're gonna take out your phones for a moment. I know this is a weird thing to say at church, but you can take out your phones and go to menti.com, M-E-N-T-I.com, and type in that code. And I want you to think for a moment, describe the family environment you grew up in using one-word answers. Okay? So what kind of family environment did you grow up in? It might have been, you know, a really affirming family, a complaining family, a tense family, an angry family, a competitive family, a fun family, a serious family, whatever. What kind of family did you grow up in? Okay, so go to menti.com and then type in that code there, 665541. Okay? And you can, there's some things. Now, what I want you to do, if you don't have a phone and someone near you does have a phone, just tell them some of your words and they'll type it in for you, okay? That's allowed. And if you have a phone and you're sitting beside someone who doesn't have a phone, ask them, so what about your family? And put it in, and we'll just see what we get here, okay? And we're going to give it a few moments, and then we're just going to review it all together. So a lot of loving families, that's a good sign. Some other things too. Crazy, a few crazies. Are you sharing your phones? Give it another 30 seconds or so. I can't read it if people are inputting, so we're going to actually have a stop time and then we're going to look at it. Cray cray! Cray cray! A few cray crays! Okay, let's stop there because if we keep adding, the words are going to get too small. Okay. Yeah, please stop there. So you can see there that loving is a big one. Supportive, caring, dysfunctional, loud, chaotic, weird, crazy, strict, working, cray-cray, adventurous, controlling. Those are all the bigger ones and all the small ones, which I think probably just had one. Oh, someone's keeping going. Busy, emotional, secretive, friends, yelling, moderate, manipulative, multi-generational, close, sporty, odd, supporting, protective, biblical, fragile, insecure, stagnant, negative, average, goofy, laughter, terrifying, complacent, yelling, living, serious, boring, broken, fighting, manipulative, terrible jokes. I'd like to hear a few of those. Fun, ethnic, awful, cool, generous, superficial, isolated, unhealthy, stressful, weird, okay. I think I got most of them. There's a few that I missed, but yeah. So you can see we all come from different places, and those places come with us, don't they? In very real ways. No matter how hard you try to run away, they follow us. They follow us. But here's a couple of truths that I want to share with you. The blessings and sins of our family go back multiple generations. And they profoundly affect who we are today. The blessings and the sins. The good stuff and the brokenness follows with us generationally. And profoundly affects who we are today. Also, here's another truth. Discipleship or following Jesus requires that we put off the sinful patterns of our family of origin and relearn how to live according to the way of God's family. two things. And that's kind of what we're really going to explore this morning as we look at the life of Joseph, actually, is what we're going to do. And family in Scripture, by the way, doesn't mean like what we think of as like the nuclear family, just like the kind of immediate people who you might have grown up with. It means 3 to 4 generations. So it's like this big arcing sort of, it's your brothers and sisters, your mom and your dad, your grandma and grandpa, your kids, but it's also your aunts, your uncles, your great aunties, your great uncles, that weird, you know, second cousin removed that kind of just always is around. He's also part of your family. And your great great grandfathers, they might not have even been alive still, but they're still considered part of your family. And so if we think about family this way, here we are in 2019, our families, in kind of how the Bible talks about family, goes back into like the 1800s. Like, that is your family. Okay, so we're thinking kind of big picture here. And the blessings and the sins, the brokenness that is there, it follows us. It follows us. But it can be broken, the sin parts. Of course, the blessings, we want that. But our families have a way of just doing life that follows us, whether we like it or not. And what happens in one generation, you often see it in other generations, hey? If you think about that or have done any kind of family history stuff, you can see that there's common generational patterns. So you often see, you know, like addictions showing up generation by generation by generation by generation. You see all kinds of addictive behaviors, poor marriage, sexual abuse, divorce, mistrust of authority, alcoholism, all kinds of different things, pieces of brokenness, they just kind of keep showing up generationally. And there's a real thing about that. In Exodus chapter 20, it says, "You shall not make for yourself an idol, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generations for those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commands." So the point of that is yeah, there's generational stuff, but guess which trumps? 3 to 4 generations of the bad stuff. 1,000 generations for the good stuff. So that's the point of that. That's why that's in there. It's actually really incredible. Becky was telling me the other day that a fetus, okay, so a woman who's pregnant and is 4 months pregnant, just 4 months pregnant, okay, and they have a little baby girl growing inside of them. That 4-month-old, is it 4 month or week? Month. 4-month-old little baby girl is already producing the eggs for its offspring at that point, okay? So if you stop to think about it, if you're pregnant and if you're 4 months old, you're not just producing the next generation, you're growing the following generation after the next generation in you at that same time. Isn't that crazy to think about? So when you think about stressors, or any kind of trauma that's happening to that mother, we know that it affects the baby inside of her. But guess what? It also affects the egg development that's inside of that little fetus. It's generational. Does that make sense? And so we see it like all the time. In our family, we're totally living with the effects of residential school generational trauma. We see it every single day. Every single day we see it in our family with our little one. And we see it in our societies all around us. And you might see it in your life too. But it happens there. But these histories are played out in the present. They impact us right now without us even being aware of it. It lives inside of us. The crazy thing is, or the beautiful thing, is that these patterns must be broken in order to become mature, spiritually alive, and emotionally healthy. Let's just do a real quick, I'm just going to do a real quick kind of glimpse of one kind of, you know, might not think of them as healthy or emotionally unhealthy, but they were both actually in the Bible. Abraham and Sarah, kind of the patriarch and matriarch of the Bible. But just even a quick overview of their lives, you can totally see these kind of dynamics at play. And I think that these kind of story, there's lots of reasons why stories are in the Bible, but one of the reasons why this particular one is in the Bible is because it documents just kind of how this works, as if God wanted to tell his children how living in this fallen world kind of works and what to expect and how to live towards redemption. So on the one hand, in Abraham and Sarah's relationship in their family, there was lots of blessings given that were passed down from generation to generation. In fact, it says that all the nations on earth would be blessed through you. So that's quite amazing. But on the other hand, there's also some sinful patterns of disobedience and brokenness that are passed down. So just take this for example. Patterns of lying, okay? Of lying. Abraham lied about Sarah twice. Isaac and Rebekah, so their kids, the next generation, their marriage was characterized by lies. Jacob, the next generation there, he lied to almost everybody. In fact, his name, anyone know what his name actually means? His name actually means liar, cheater, deceiver. Like that, okay? And then 10 of Jacob's children lied about Joseph's death. And we're going to look at that story a little bit more. Remember? They like faked his death. So there's this pattern of lying that's happening there. Patterns of favoritism by at least one parent in each generation. So Abraham favored Ishmael. Next generation, Isaac favored Esau. Next generation, Jacob favored Joseph and then later Benjamin. You see what's happening? Brothers experiencing cut off from each other in each generation. So Isaac and Ishmael, which were Abraham's sons, they were cut off from each other. Jacob fled from his brother Esau, and they were cut off for years and years. And Joseph was cut off from his family. Generational patterns here. Poor intimacy in marriage. You might think, what? Really? Ooh, yeah. Well, look at it. Abraham had, like, he had a child out of wedlock. Like, with Sarah's slave girl. He got her pregnant and then sent her away. That might tell you something about the level of intimacy in their marriage. I mean, regardless of all the whole, there's all kinds of different cultural stuff there, which is all important, but just on a base level, like, I don't think they were getting along very well. Rebecca and Isaac, next generation, they had a terrible relationship. Jacob, the following generation, had two wives and two concubines. Tell me how that was going to work out. Like, there's, you know, they kind of were, I'm sure that it was kind of culturally appropriate and all the rest of it, but come on. It's messed up, and that's the whole point. There's the whole point. There are generational patterns and scripts that are handed down to us. What messages did you receive about marriage, for example, growing up? Or singleness. What messages did you receive about singleness growing up? What messages or scripts did your family hand you about sex or intimacy? What about money? What about what it means to be successful? What about how to deal with anger or grief or loss or conflict? How did your family view other churches or other faiths? Right? These are all scripts that are pretty much handed to us. And we live them out, whether we know it or not. Okay, I think you get that point. But what I want to say is there's some good news about this. Your biological family may determine what you look like, but they do not have to determine your future. God determines your future. Ephesians 1 talks about that. We've been adopted into God's family. And so part of the process of discipleship and of following Jesus is Him reparenting us in a different way. Like those negative or broken or sinful parts of our history that we've just brought with us, He confronts them and gently reworks them. And we're going to see what that looks like. So, those who cannot learn from the past are doomed to repeat it, someone once said. We're going to look at Joseph, like I said. So you can not turn to your Bibles, because 25% of Genesis, which has 50 chapters, 25% of it is about Joseph. So, We're going to look at some scripture this morning, and it's all totally rooted in scripture, but if I get you going, we're going to be reading like 12 and a half chapters or something like that. And so we're just not going to do that. But we are going to look at Joseph this morning as someone who went back in order to go forward. In Genesis 37, that's where he first appears. He's about 17 years old, we think. And he's number 11 of 12 sons. But he's the favorite, like I already mentioned, of his father, who was Jacob. So, and Jacob's grandfather was Abraham. So you can kind of, this is like the sort of the lineage of the Hebrew people here. And he comes from a complex blended family, which I just mentioned. His dad had two wives and two concubines, and they all had kids, and they all lived under the same house, like, or under the same tent or whatever. And it was probably pretty pretty interesting times. And he was the favorite of his dad. And he appears, at the beginning anyways, pretty kind of immature and arrogant. Like, do you remember what he had? Like, he had these dreams. You remember this? Yeah. And then how did he go and tell, what was his dreams about, for starters? Oh. Come on. There's lots of people that went to Sunday school. He was going to be awesome and they were going to suck. There's Cornelius' translation. That was basically it, and that's how he communicated it. He was like, he was the wheat, a bunch of wheat gathered together. What is that called? A sheaf. Sheaf of wheat. Yeah, thanks. What's a sheath then? Oh, a sheath is what you put your sword in. Okay, never mind. Never mind me while I'm just working out etymology here. And that all the other sheaths of wheat, it doesn't flow. I don't know. We got to figure out a different word. They would all bow down to him. And he just kind of goes and tells this all to his brothers, okay? Is that a smart thing to do? Like, it's a little bit arrogant. I mean, it might have been true. And actually, if you follow the story, it ended up actually being very literally true. But was it a very mature thing for him to go, hey, guess what, guys? You're going to bow down to me one day. Yeah, that'll end you up in a pit. Oh, actually, that's exactly what happened. And so it just kind of fostered their hatred of him. And so it just kind of, like, and the way he was, it's just like emotional immaturity. It was just like, that's not the smartest thing to do. That's just kind of arrogant, actually. Even though you might have been right. It's just kind of how you do it really matters. And so their hatred of him grew until they faked his death, threw him in a pit, and sold him to Egypt, to Egyptian slave traders. Okay, so, hold on a second. Just imagine that for a moment. Imagine being Joseph, just for a moment. And all that's happening. So here, you've lost your parents. You've lost your family. You're transported quite a ways away. You've lost your culture. You've lost kind of where you're from. You've lost your language, most likely. They spoke a different language there. Your freedom. Your hopes, all in one day. All in one day. Imagine, what would that be like? Some of you don't have to imagine that hard, because maybe your parents, that happened to them in residential schools, I would say. Boom, 150,000 First Nation, Métis, and Inuit kids. That was pretty much the story. Just imagine that for a sec. This is Joseph. And then, when he's in Egypt, he gets falsely accused of rape, sexual assault from the wife of his master. And so then he's thrown into prison, and he's in prison, and then there's a possibility of release, and then he's forgot about again for 10 more years, 10 to 13 more years. Just imagine this for a sec. Like, what would be happening in your own heart in this time? Like, maybe some bitterness, some anger, some, oh, gee, what's going on, God? Like, what on earth is happening? But then he remained faithful to God and was pulled out of prison and made second in command of all of Egypt. What? Someone said, cray cray up there. That sounds pretty crazy to me. Like, talk about flip-flop all over the place. But he continued to walk with God until the end and ended up being a blessing to Egypt, but also to his own family. He went back. Joseph went back in order to go forward. But how did he do this? In other words, what were his secrets? What on earth did he see that I don't think I would have seen had I been rotting in an Egyptian cell for all these years? Had my family disowned me and faked my death and threw me in a pit and sold me to slave traders? I don't know. How did he do it? First thing, I got four, just so you know. And I am keeping track of the time because I don't want to be interrupted by a remember having a fire drill, remember that, and it's going to happen. He had a sense of the bigness of God. Here, let me read this to you. Genesis 45. I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into slavery. Just saying. Yeah, in Egypt. But don't be upset and don't be angry with yourselves for selling me to this place. It was God who sent me here ahead of you to preserve your lives. God sent me ahead of you to keep you and your families alive and to preserve many survivors. So it was God who sent me here, not you. And he is the one who made me an advisor to Pharaoh, the manager of his entire palace and governor of all of Egypt. God is at work in all things. You got to hear me. God is at work in all things. He's not the cause of all things. Okay? Evil exists. You know, the shirt blank happens. That is true. God does not cause all things, but he is in all things. God is always at work behind the scenes, working mostly, in my experience anyways, and maybe yours, maybe not, I don't know, but mostly in pretty mysterious ways. Like, what would it have been like for God to be working in the pit with Joseph? What would it have been like for God to be working in the Egyptian dungeon with Joseph? What would it have been like for God to be working with Joseph in Pharaoh's palace as second in command of the entire nation of Egypt? And that was a superpower at the time. Like, we're talking big stuff here. God's with him. And Joseph had this sense of the bigness of God. Nothing is wasted when we live our lives in surrender to Jesus. He said, Joseph says further on in a few chapters later, you intended to harm me, but God intended it all for good. He brought me to this position so I could save the lives of many people. He had a bigness, sense of the bigness of God. Max Lucado said, in God's hands, intended evil becomes eventual good. Intended evil becomes eventual good. That's good, hey? Amen to that? Yeah. He's working. One of Joseph's ways that he went back in order to go forward is he had a sense of God's bigness. Number two, he honestly faced the sadness and losses of his family. Many people are resistant. Many of us here are resistant to go back and to face the losses or the griefs. The pain, the brokenness that we're coming from. Some of us, like I was barely 17. I graduated and I was gone. I mean, partly it had to do with I was like growing up in this tiny little town in the middle of Alberta, and it was like there's nothing there. But a large part of it was I'm getting the heck out of here and I'm not coming back. But guess what? It follows you. You can't run. It doesn't work that way. And Joseph, though, honestly faced the sadness and losses of his family. He wept repeatedly. Check this out. Joseph could stand it no longer. I'm reading a little bit before what it says on the screen. There were many people in the room, and he said to his attendants, "Out, all of you!" So he was alone with his brothers. This is after they had come. So there was a famine in where his brothers were from, and they came to Egypt because God had led Joseph to be really smart and to like save up food and seed and all the rest of it. And so Egypt had a lot, and they could share. And so, but his family did not. And so they came sort of hat in hand to Joseph, to Egypt. They didn't actually know it was Joseph. So he was alone with his brothers. And this is sort of the great reveal time. You know, on those shows, those home renovation shows where they have the big sort of, "I can't believe what you did to my house. It's so amazing." You know, that this is kind of the big reveal thing here. He couldn't stand it anymore. He was alone with his brothers when he told them who he was. Then he broke down and wept. He wept so loudly that the Egyptians could hear him, and word of it quickly carried to Pharaoh's palace. "I'm Joseph," he said to his brothers. "Is my father still alive?" But his brothers were speechless. Can you imagine? Just think about that for a moment. Wait a minute. We put you in a pit. We sold you. What's that? As a slave. Yeah. And here you are. We're coming. Like, this is like cray cray. I'm sorry if I'm overusing that word. They were stunned to realize that Joseph was standing there in front of them. "Please come closer." What would it have taken Joseph to say that to his brothers? "Come closer." And he said again, "I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into slavery." He faced it. He faced it. Can you see that in this passage? He didn't minimize or rationalize the painful years. "I am Joseph, who you sold into slavery." Some of us might say it like this, with a knife. "I am Joseph, who you sold into slavery," you know? But he didn't do that. He didn't let bitterness or anger. Well, he might have actually. And I kind of think there was probably a lot of ups and downs. But in the end, we get this beautiful picture. He faced it, and was in the end able to truly forgive and bless his brothers, actually, who had betrayed him. Isn't that crazy? Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that redemptive? Doesn't that sound like the gospel? And he gave his first two children, Joseph gave his first two children names that reflected this painful past, Manasseh and Ephraim. Manasseh means to forget, because God had enabled him to forget all his troubles. And Ephraim means fruitful, because God had made him fruitful in his new land of suffering. Weeping with joy, this is a few verses later, he embraced Benjamin, his father's new favorite. And Benjamin did the same. Then Joseph kissed each of his brothers and wept over them. And after that they began talking freely with him. You can just get this sense of, he's not going to do one of those to us. It's amazing. And the third way, Joseph went back in order to go forward. He rewrote his life script according to God's purposes. There's many reasons, like I've already mentioned here, that he could have just gone down the path of bitterness. And many of us have plenty of reasons to say, you know, my life is a mistake, I'm worthless, I never should trust anybody, it's just too painful, I shouldn't feel, so I'm just going to cut all that stuff off. Relate to any of that stuff? Like, we come from places, don't we? Real places. Real situations. But Joseph worked through that stuff. Many of us, I think, don't read the script that we're handed from our families. It's kind of like, think about that, like an actual script. Like, imagine an actor being just handed the script and said, "Go, there you go. Like, now you're on, we're filming you." But that's often how many of us live our lives, unexamined pasts. Just kind of like, with all the stuff influencing us, but not examining it. But Joseph didn't do that. He reflected and opened the door to God's future by rewriting it with God. He reworked the script with God according to God's purposes. Like I mentioned earlier, the real measure of our sense of self is after we've been with our parents for 3 days. You know? How old do you feel then? Have you reverted into old patterns or have dealt with those old patterns? Received healing or broken free from that? Face it. This story has blood stains all over it, literally. Remember what they did with his coat of many colors? Dipped it in blood. Said, look, your son is dead. It's got tear stains all over it. But the story doesn't run from the presence of evil. Rather, it reframes it. Reframes it. Joseph rewrote his life script according to God's purposes. Fourth and lastly, he partnered with God to be a blessing. It can seem like a totally impossible path, especially with those deep, deep wounds. Like you can imagine him saying, is God safe? Is God good? Is God good? Can he be trusted? And I would say that Joseph clearly had a deep and abiding relationship with God to carry him and ground him. How deep is your relationship with God? Does it carry you and ground you? And when the moment when his brothers showed up, he was ready. He was actually ready. I don't know how prepared he was for that. You can't really get a sense of that. But they showed up, and he was ready. He didn't react out of bitterness. And he partnered with God to be a blessing. This story starts in a pit, and it definitely could have ended there, hey? But it doesn't. So, just reviewing. Joseph, going back in order to go forwards, he had a big sense of God. The big, big picture. God is working in everything, always behind the scenes, you know, just working things, helping, confronting, healing. Joseph faced the sadness and losses of his family. He didn't run from them. Oh, by the way, that Romans 8 passage is a great one for the working all things. God works all things for good together with, or here, I'll read it for you because I'm going to screw it up. 8:28. And we know that God causes everything to work together for the good of those who love God and are called according to his purposes for them. Further on, this is what isn't often read in this passage, but further on it says, this is Paul talking, okay? Does it mean that he no longer loves us if we have trouble or calamity or are persecuted or hungry or destitute or in danger or threatened with death? No. Despite all these things, overwhelming victory is ours through Christ who loves us. He faced it. He rewrote his life scripts according to God's purposes, and he partnered with God along the way. Here's the amazing things. The sinful parts of our family histories don't have to define us. Say that to yourself. Actually, let's say it to each other. The sinful part of our family histories don't have to define us. They don't have to, actually. And there is healing and like we can break stuff. Yeah. Being part of God's family means we learn a new way of being family. It doesn't mean we disregard all the blessings of our families, and it's not like throwing our families under the bus here. It's just the bad parts, right? It's just the bad parts. Just the parts that are troublesome. God decided in advance to adopt us into his own family by bringing us to himself through Jesus Christ. This is what he wanted to do, and it gave him great pleasure. Great pleasure. Let's take a few moments, okay?